Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 198 with the title, Scaling Care with Heart. And I have the absolute honor and privilege to welcome Amrit Dhaliwal. Amrit is a dynamic entrepreneur and CEO transforming the UK home care through a purpose-led franchising model that blends innovation, quality, and social impact. And when I asked Amrit to describe his superpower, he said that it is turning traditional sectors into scalable, purpose-led ventures. Hello, Amrit. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for having me here. Great to be on the show.
Absolute pleasure. We were just chatting away in the green room about my own experience in social care homes, and so through parents and parents-in-law. So I'm sure we've got lots to talk about. So, and you're based in London, is that right?
I am, that's right, yes.
Wow, fantastic. It's nice to have someone in the same time zone for a change.
Yeah, there we go, yeah. Makes a change for you, I think you were saying.
Yeah, it does. And we probably share in the same rain cloud at the moment. It's absolutely pelting down here, and I think it probably must be all over the country right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Amrit, you're, by the sounds of it, a serial entrepreneur and getting involved with many different startups and models. So what got you into the home care business, and what is your, with a heart, if you like, what's your passion for this?
I think, like most good things in my life, Joe, this was also my wife's idea. So we're sitting in a cafe in 2012, and I was like, Trisha, I've got lots to give and I don't know who wants it. You know, I was in restaurants and catering businesses at the time, and I was working long hours and so on, and the return was fine. But when I think about the time and the emotional investment, the financial reward just wasn't really there comparatively. And my wife's a dentist. Her family's been in nursing homes for the last 30 odd years. And she said, have you thought about domiciliary care? And I was about 25 or 26 at the time. And I said what you would expect any 25-year-old to say, which was, what the hell is that? You know, and the next thing I know, I'm speaking to all the different franchisors around the country. I've bought a home care franchise within, 60 days of this conversation. I'm then running my care businesses and then going out to Oxfordshire for my doing that, driving 3 hours to Richmond where my restaurants were, and so on. And this is 2012. In September, I signed the contract. In November, I got my Care Quality Commission registration. And in, I think, 2013, sort of February, I took my first client on. And it was around March or April 2013 that I realized that this was it. This was what I needed to do for the next 20 years. I needed to fix home care, fix franchising. And both of those things in the home care space in the UK were a bit archaic. And I thought, there's got to be other people like me that want to run businesses and scale them and just don't know how. And I felt like the market was set up very much for people that were from the sector, and I really wasn't. I still see myself as very much a home care outsider, but working from within. And I've set up Wallfinch with that in mind for entrepreneurs that want to get involved in the sector, but want more of a plug and play model and to help them scale.
That's often the way, though, isn't it? It's many businesses are
the founder is the inventor, the idea person, the creator of something. But sometimes the better businesses are run by people who are one step backwards. They're not driving from their passion of the solution. They're driving from their passion of the business itself to create a sustainable business model that serves its customers, looks at all the dynamics. Whereas the inventor mindset is too focused on the product sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of both and. You know, for me, the problem I was trying to solve was something else. It wasn't that I had, I mean, actually, really conveniently, at that time, my late grandfather had come over from India, from Punjab. He'd lived in a village that my family's lived in for many generations. And there is no care. You take care of your elderly and so on. But as it happens, all of the kids have moved away in Canada, America, the UK, and so on, all in search for a better life. And so, you know, we had my grandfather fly over here and he spent a couple of years with us. And at that time, I really got a firsthand experience on what it felt like to have elderly people living with you and how you can support them and how you need to keep people independent, but still keep... It's kind of a blend between independence and giving somebody that support. And I think that's the hard part. And I really sort of saw that firsthand. And then I went into sort of thinking, well, okay, you're right, great. So I can see there's a need for this. So I've become a franchisee myself to try and fix that need. And then as a franchisee, I saw, well, here's a different problem. You know, the problem is actually in the systems and in how archaic the whole model is. So then I went off to fix that problem. And actually that I thought was the longer term problem, because actually the mission piece is finding more people like me that want to do that, or more people like me back in 2012 that want to do that now. You know, when I look at it, I think in the last 5 years, I probably could have earned a lot more money being a home care provider and just scaling my own home care businesses. But I can make a lot more impact being the CEO of Wallfinch and scaling it through franchising and going nationwide.
That's interesting. So you have the passion, but you also have the entrepreneurial skills, as you say, to franchise it out, to have a wider impact. So you said, well, to paraphrase you, the home care system is broken. Or was broken and has been broken. What were the key things in there that you identified that needed fixing, you know, right now, that you tackled?
Yeah, there's a multitude of things. I actually wrote a book that came out earlier this year, and all the proceeds go to the care workers charity. It's called Time to Thrive, the Home Care Revolution. And in that, I set out kind of a 12-step model. But I think anyone within the sector understands that the way that the sector is funded is problematic. So, you know, the government's really kind of left us to our own devices. We get paid through local authority contracts, you know, a rate that is not sustainable and is not reasonable. You know, we can't run sustainable businesses from that. And therefore, yeah, and I saw this back in 2012 and I thought, well, okay, the whole market's running after these government contracts. I'm going to run in the other direction and focus on building a private business, a self-funded business, which I did. You know, went from zero to a million in that few years and really built this very kind of sustainable margins-led business, which allowed me to provide a better quality service because I could hire, you know, staff that were calmer, it was more sustainable, I paid them very well and so on. And we were able to spend that time training them. And then, you know, if I think about that today, I mean, that problem still remains in a different way today. Mm. And then, you know, for me, I think a lot of it comes down to the way that the market is branded. And I think, well, okay, the NHS is not branded the way home care is branded. And if I think about, you know, the campaigns that have been done for nurses, you know, we think about a nurse and think, wow, you know, that is a really professional role and it's really supportive. But we think about care workers and there's almost a level of embarrassment saying, well, I'm a care worker. And that is unbelievable to me. I think, you know, it's work that I couldn't do. It's amazing work that I think is so important. And if we think about the lockdown and COVID and so on, I mean, care workers were people that kept the country spinning. you know, the wheels would have fallen off. But I feel like we, as a country, do not do enough to kind of help rebrand that. So part of my mission is rebranding the role of the care worker, professionalizing it, you know, really jazzing it up and putting it out there. And then, you know, I'm 38. And so when I talk to my friends about being in home care, they're like, well, what the hell is that? Come on. You know, that's not cool and so on. And they're all in finance and this and that and, you know, all of the sexy stuff. But the way I sort of see it, I think, well, okay, well, why can we not rebrand the role of the entrepreneur within this sector? This sector is operated due to and by entrepreneurs. It is not led by the government on the whole. You know, it is very much entrepreneurs that are in the sector driving it and creating change. And so I kind of think, well, you know, when we're in the age of your Gary V's and your Alex Amosis and, you know, your Cody Sanchez's, you know, entrepreneurialism is cool, but home care isn't yet. And so what can we do about that? And then that will attract really interesting talent from different sectors who will come with their own thinking and help redefine home care, which, you know, happens to be the Wolf Fincher strapline, because I really do believe that. I think that you can truly do that through the power of franchising, because people like yourself might wake up one morning and think, gosh, you know, this would be an interesting thing to do. And you come with your own skills, bring that here. And think, well, okay, gosh, how do we then, you know, I've got a friend of mine that's a creative and he's been paramount in helping morph my thinking in how the brand looks and feels and so on. And it's just different people that can impact along the way in very different ways.
Yeah. I'm currently, I suppose, indirectly through parents, a procurer of domiciliary or residential care. And you're right. We've noticed that it's frustrating, very frustrating, especially when you're dealing with local authority. You have the interviews. They tell you, yes, you can qualify for 15 minutes a day or half an hour a day, and this is what we've contracted with the provider to provide. Then, and we found it very frustrating, and that the provider turns up intermittently, different times. There's no stability there. Elderly father-in-law wants a breakfast roughly at breakfast time, and when someone turns up at 11, he's in the mood for lunch, and he's had to make his own breakfast, and that defeats the whole object of the care, because we didn't want him walking around his property with a Zimmer frame, potentially tripping over or falling or knocking something or having to bend down. And so we found the actual provision of service to be very, very variable. And whether that's because it's a local authority funded scheme or whether because I believe we now have the right to opt out of the local government and take the funding and do your own procurement, which we didn't opt to do. We opted to keep it through the local government at this time. But we did probably end up going through the same provider anyway. And it's very frustrating as this side of the fence, trying to liaise with companies who are doing their best, absolutely doing their best, juggling multiple balls, I'm sure, and people who care deeply to get it right. But from a customer perspective, if you like, it's not quite there yet.
And I think a lot of that comes down to the way that the government buys care. And so, you know, one of my sort of big pieces has been really moving away from that. And I think, you know, when we work with the local authority or government, we work with them in the capacity of kind of direct payments, that personal budget that you were referring to. Now, where we don't have that, we tend to work with private pay. And it means that both yourself as a procurer and us as a provider have control in the situation. And there's no third party that's not there. You're sort of saying, oh, actually, you know, it should be 15 minutes. I mean, gosh, what can you do in 15 minutes? You know, that should be illegal, you know, as far as I'm concerned. You know, you can't go into someone's property and do anything in 15 minutes apart from check that they are there and okay. And then it's time to put your coat on and leave. And it's not feasible. I mean, you know, also when you think about that, you think, well, how much is that care worker being paid to go to that 15-minute visit? Then they're driving there, they're driving back, you know, the time, the mileage and all of that. It's unreasonable, in my opinion, to ask them to do that. You know, unless someone lives in some sort of housing colony and there's, you know, five houses there and you're going back door to door or whatever, and it's, you know, 30 seconds between houses, okay, you know. But the reality of the situation is how disruptive for that elderly person at home, thinking, you know, maybe they've got dementia, maybe they've got other sort of situations going on, and I think someone's rushing in, rushing out. Maybe, and also you cannot blame the care worker because they're trying to fit in all of these things. You can't even blame the provider. They're trying to keep a sustainable business to keep the care workers going, keeping clients healthy and so on. And, you know, but the way that the work is contracted is problematic. And I think, you know, as providers, I think, you know, really we need to march with our, you know, vote with our feet and just march away from that local authority work, unless it is fairly commissioned.
Yeah, I was a trustee of a charity in Portsmouth 7 or 8 years ago, and we as a charity provided domiciliary care. I remember we ended up having to walk away from contracts because they just weren't viable. You couldn't deliver, and they were trying to bid 15-minute contracts almost at minimum wage at the time. And you're right, that doesn't give any scope for travel, doesn't give any scope for time off, doesn't give any scope for training or anything else or personal other personal needs. And it was just unsustainable. Providers were losing money on every visit, on every contract. And they just thought, well...
And that's not reasonable, right? Well, you know, as a provider, you know, you are also an entrepreneur. You might have shareholders. You have responsibility to them as well. You know, both to provide a really good quality service, pay your staff really well, but also to enjoy dividends as a shareholder. I think there's nothing wrong or inappropriate in that. You know, it's the whole, it's a way that the system is all kind of curated. I think it's really important to have, you know, everyone in that system should win. You know, the carer should win, the client should win, the entrepreneur behind the service should win. You know, the community should win, and as a result, the greater economy will win. And I think, you know, if we think about it from that abundance model, I think there's a lot to be said there. I actually have my own podcast called Walking with Wallfinch, and the episode's not out yet, but it will be by the time this episode's out. I had an interview with Professor Martin Green, and a really interesting gentleman. He's the CEO of the Care England, and he talks in that episode about how the NHS is funded, and actually if we took a portion of that funding, gave it to the social care sector, as a, you know, social care providers would be able to reduce the amount of burden that is levied onto the NHS. And actually we're talking about a tiny proportion of that funding. But it's just not there, you know, because actually home care or care doesn't win votes, you know, and that's fundamentally where we're at.
I think you said it earlier about it's not seen as a glamorous thing, is it? Nurses and hospitals somehow are vote winners and they're seen as glamorous.
Well, they've been rebranded, you see. So, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, I remember there's this wonderful campaign around the NHS and nurses. It's wonderful, you know, if you think about all of the sort of civil type services, you know, the army and so on, and the RAF. I mean, you see adverts on TV. Where is that for social care? You know, we are the reason that people are kept at home or out of hospital, and you know, a bed at hospital. I think the last count was, I think this number has gone up. It certainly will by the time this episode's out, but it's over £800 a night. You know, and you think, gosh, yeah, that is a phenomenal amount of investment from the taxpayers' money, and I think, but we're able to remedy that. And also, most people don't want to be in hospital. Most people want to be at home.
Yeah, that's for sure. Certainly, all of my parents-in-law have wanted to stay at home as long as possible. But it gets to a point where you just can't do it. You haven't got the accessible property. There's no help to make it accessible in some cases. It doesn't need to be huge amounts, but you know, getting a hospital bed in there or getting some other way, or the toilet's upstairs, the kitchen's downstairs. Where do you put somebody? There's no stair lift or anything else in the property. It's complicated. And I look at what happened with my father-in-law beginning of this year. He had a fall. It's not his first fall. He probably clumsy. He was trying to use a rollator instead of a Zimmer frame type model. He probably tipped it. It fell and it ends up in a pile on the floor. Walking frame on top of him, two broken ribs. And it took until the care visit later that day to find him. And he ended up in hospital. Potentially, they thought he was going to end up on palliative care and end of life. But he managed to do an Azimuth and pull it around and it got better. But I look at the time that my wife was off work with that, the worry that we had as a family, the time I had to take off work. So we're self-employed, but both of us, and so she couldn't earn, she couldn't deliver the business. Then you think about all the time invested in the actual hospitalization of my father-in-law for that 10 days, 15 days, and then having to offboard him out of hospital, onboard him back into domiciliary care, that whole process, the number of people involved in that. Had he had proper care at the beginning, then that would have cut out all of this anguish and time from the working generation, yep, and the hospitalization and the care he needed. So you're right, the prevention in that scenario would have been a better investment.
Yeah, and I think this is where my mind is really at with the way that we're scaling Wolfinch. It's really focusing on prevention. It's focusing on where we ought to be focusing as a community, as a nation. And I think really that for me is all part of creating a solution, you know, because we all know the problem. And certainly if you're within the sector, you know what the problems are. And we can sit and we can talk for an hour about all of the problems that are there, which is vast. Or we can actually start taking some action and saying, well, okay, what am I doing differently as a provider? Am I charging enough so that I can pay my staff enough? So is the local authority paying me? If they're not, am I going to focus on private pay work? And how do I then start to create a business out of private pay work? And actually, you know, is there a franchise model that I can get involved in? Are there coaches or what have you? How do I actually scale that to ensure that that business is sustainable? And I think that's it, really. I mean, I'm very process driven and focused on results. And I think it really serves itself well within the domiciliary care market.
Mm. Is there a challenge on the supply side of the talent, of the resources, and the care workers? Is there a challenge getting people to see it as a worthy profession to invest in, or are we still struggling to get the resourcing?
I think there's a few different challenges. Certainly, as we currently speak, there's been changes within the way that you're getting staff from abroad, and that's problematic because that really alleviated a lot of the issues that we had in the market. It created an increase in supply. So you've got that problem. Then you've got problem on a more local market. But for me, And again, maybe I'm too simplistic, but for me, I think often the problem is a lack of activity problem. And I think if you're able to get out there enough and you are making enough phone calls and you're speaking to enough people, you know, you will get a member of staff. And you know, you sort of look at a kind of sort of 2-to-1 ratio when you're looking at clients to care workers invariably. And actually that works, right? So you don't need lots of carers to make a successful home care business. You know, a successful home care business might look like about £1 million in revenue with, you know, maybe 40 odd clients and maybe, you know, sort of 25 care workers. So it's not a huge, we're not talking huge numbers of people, but then I think the focus needs to be very much on retention of those people. So yes, you know, my first home care business was in Oxfordshire, so very affluent area. And, you know, I realized really early doors that I'm not going to get tens of people applying to my job every day. And I spoke to a colleague of mine within the sector from a different brand. And I said, oh, so, you know, what are you doing? How are you getting staff? I mean, he was sort of 5 years ahead of me. And said, well, I spent about, this is back in 2013, he was spending £1,500 a month on Indeed adverts. And I thought, gosh, I don't have £1,500 a month for a start. And second of all, you know, he's getting 10 people in, but then losing 9 and then having a net growth of 1. I was like, this has got to be something something else, and I was talking to multiple other providers, and everyone's in a similar situation, different version of. And I thought, well, okay, now what? And then I sort of went back to the office, and I remember looking at my team. And I thought, so what is our difference? You know, how do we change this? Because I don't have £1,500 a month, and I don't want to grow by a net of one people. So how do I change this? And I thought, okay, so I'm doing all of this activity. So we're going to get really focused on who we're hiring. And we're going to say no a lot, which is actually unheard of within the sector. And so we're going to say no to people that we think don't want to do this, are not people I would hire for my own parents. And you know, we're just going to say no to basically 50% of the applicants that come through. And so we're going to get super focused on who do we want and what is the purpose of getting this taking this job into. You know, and I really thought about that, and I started doing values-based recruitment. And so that really helped. So that one thing alone made me get the right place. And so the right care workers were coming in, and they were sticking around longer just automatically because they wanted to be there. So I didn't have that churn just from that one app. And then I thought, okay, well, now, so I've got care workers here. I'm not. Go, there's an even, you know, further reduced supply. So now they've become even more like gold dust to me. So now what? And I thought, well, okay, so now I need to, there's not lots of them. I need to get to know these people. And so I made a point to get to know every member of staff, you know, their dog's name and who's got chickens and how many kids have they got and what's their names. And, you know, they've just run a marathon and their husband's doing X. You know, oh, someone's working at a mini factory. Great. And you get to know people. And then you start to understand, you know, what motivates people. What is it? Is it money? Is it purpose? Is it the fact that they want to be at Little Timmy's football match on a Wednesday afternoon every Wednesday? Great. You know, let's get to know these people. Because actually, if I was a consultant and I had a client that was generating £50,000 a year for me, I'd be falling over myself. I would be sending them birthday cards for their children's birthdays, for goodness sakes. But a care worker who's generating the same for a business, we're like, oh, whatever, Sarah's gone, Samantha's come in, now, you know. We just don't have that thinking there. And so I flipped that thinking, and I said this to my core team in the office. If you think I'm paying your salary, you are dead wrong. It's the care workers. They are driving the whole thing. So how do we keep them going? How do we keep them in this business? And then it was thinking, well, how do I increase the supply? And that comes down to simple, let's get out there. Let's, you know, let's do the press-ups. And if we're not doing the press-ups and then complaining about I'm not getting care workers in, I don't buy that. You know, I think it all comes down to, right, let's do more work. Let's change the work. Let's tinker with it. Let's drive the data. You know, I did this. That didn't really work. Is it because the system is broken or is it a volume problem? And invariably, it's a volume problem. You know, I had a friend of mine in the sector. He said, oh, well, I sent out 300 leaflets and nothing came back through it. And I thought, okay, cool. So, and then what did you do? He said, well, nothing. I was like, okay, so have you tried sending out 3,000 leaflets? And so sent out 3,000 leaflets and he got something back from it. I was like, great. So now what happened if you sent out 3,000 leaflets every day, you know, for example? And yes, then there's a budget issue and whatever, but actually, and then what happens if I'm doing that every day, but then I'm also, you know, asking those people that are coming in for their referrals? And then, you know, 6 months later, I'm speaking to said care workers that have been working with me, and I think they're wonderful. Hey, who else do you know that is like you, that is your friend, yeah, has a value set that can work for us? And all of a sudden, you'll keep growing by 1, 2, 5 people. And if you can retain those people, you will develop a sustained, scalable business. But also, you'll do something really magical, which is upskilling that same person. Now, what you find with businesses with a lot of churn is that they've never got anyone around to upskill them. You know, they can't teach them the next thing and the next thing with medication and the whatever else it might be. But if you've got somebody that is sticking around for a 5-year period, or you can really say, hey, look, you know, I've got this next course and we're doing this thing on osteoporosis and now diabetes and then so on and then so forth. And all of a sudden, 5 years later, you've got this wowzers care worker that is just phenomenal. Mm. And they can talk to a tissue viability nurse for you, and they can, you know, talk to district nurses, and they can have these really meaningful conversations that historically have all been reserved for management staff. And my thinking is flipping that on its head. It's thinking, why can we not give the care workers some of the most responsible work within the business, because they are the ones that are out there the whole time? You know, the only thing stopping us is upskilling them.
Yeah, I go back to when I was a trustee of this local charity providing domiciliary care. The training, the compliance, the CQC regulations, so much so that this charity even started its own training business, e-learning company, because it was cheaper to build its own e-learning platform to train its staff and then sell it to other training care providers than it was to sort of outsource somebody else. Because you know, you need people trained in stoma care. You need people trained in being able to give a certain type of injection or diabetes or whatever it may be. Foot care, all these other type of things. So you need people who are multifaceted or rounded professionals. And I think that's what we probably forget. We think home care is just incontinence or feeding or cleaning. It's a whole load of specialisms there that you have to be a nurse in a package, really, don't you? You have to be able to provide all the things that you would get if you're in a hospital bed in the community wherever Absolutely. Possible.
Absolutely.
So that factoring that into your care package and your whatever the local government is giving you is really tricky. As you say, you're trying to change how you're funded by looking at the private sector, looking at different partnerships. So that's the challenge you're facing now, isn't it? It's higher net worth individuals who are looking at premium care homes or premium at home services.
Yeah, and I think as time goes on, so many people fall into that bracket, and it might be, you know, somebody that was historically kind of that didn't quite fall into that bracket because the thresholds have changed over time, or property prices have gone up, and so on. And so all of a sudden, so many people fall into that bracket. So actually, I think that'll only happen more and more over time. And it's then about saying, well, what is the, you know, most sustainable way of doing this? And what is the most fair way of doing this? You know, you've got to think, well, okay, how do I sustainably and fairly turn a profit? And I think that's what it's really thinking about everybody in that kind of circle winning.
Yeah, something my mother's come to terms with, having spent, 2 years of paying for care homes for my father, in excess of £120,000, I think, in care home costs. She's decided to invest £120,000 in her house to make it accessible. So she's building wet rooms, she's building a downstairs, she's even planning out where her bed could go in the living room, remodeling the downstairs, so that she can now foresee herself staying at home for as long as physically possible with domiciliary care, rather than having to ship herself off to a care home, sell her property to finance it, whatever. She can now, hopefully, the plan is for her to stay there till the right to the very end. Yeah. And I think if people started thinking about that in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, about how can they create a sustainable home environment for them and not be reliant on care homes, and they can keep the asset in their property as well, all of that, maybe we need to educate the population as well on how to fund these things.
I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. I think there's probably also, we're probably at a point in time where there's more products that are needed. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in my book is about, well, okay, are there insurance products that could be provided to people from this, from, you know, that are going through this? I mean, there's already kind of equity products with lenders that I've come across in the past and so on, and we've seen some clients utilizing and so forth, you know. But what else is there that would help kind of pull that plaster off and help us really just move forward from this?
Yeah, and providing better training and support for relatives. And that's one thing we learned as a as children of elderly parents, is that we were woefully unprepared for what was expected of us, and we needed educating. You know, I said at the time to the anyone who would listen that when you're having a baby, you kind of you're in this club. Everyone knows what having a baby means. You know, you've got antenatal clinics, you've got lots of parenting books, you've got all these sort of things, you've got these little clubs and Facebook groups. But nobody has this kind of what it means to be a sandwich generation in your 60s, trying to hold a living, deal with your children who are in their 30s, and then suddenly your parents become children again.
Yes.
And you've got all this navigating this care system, navigating the terminology, getting through to people, having conversations with medical professionals who seem keen to treat the physical but not capable of treating holistically the mental and the well-being side. It's almost like your ribs are fixed. Now off you go. Then we'll deal with it.
Yeah.
So it's education for the relatives that is also needed. And you say, I think destigmatizing the profession, professionalizing it, and also making it a career opportunity for many people, then as a child or someone who's in care, then I wouldn't feel the stigma either. And my employer wouldn't know the stigma. And it's accepted that I'm going to need that flexibility and time. And people see that being a carer as something more than just fitting it in. Yeah. You get maternity leave, you get paternity leave. Why can't I have care leave?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's absolutely it. I mean, you know, and actually one of the opening gambits in my book is exactly that. You know, if I've got a PA, then that's something to be proud of. If I've got a nanny, that's okay. But if I've got a care worker, you know, that's something to be embarrassed about. And I think that thinking just needs morphing, because actually more and more people are living with that, dealing with that, and then thinking about a tool, just a toolkit that you, Joe, and your partner can live with, or I think, well, okay, how do I navigate this whole very complex thing where, yeah, you very much are in that sandwich generation of I've got both ends popping off, and how do I fix that? How do I, you know, cope with that? Also, emotionally, how do you cope with that? You know, because the pressure is immense as well.
Yeah, and it's not just elderly; it's people of all stages of life. I'm also mindful of this because my wife had a total knee replacement 2 weeks ago, and she got sent home, no care package. You know, she, under the Equality Act 2010, she doesn't even qualify as disabled, because to be qualified that, you have to have a disability that lasts more than a year. Yeah. So having a knee replacement, so she doesn't get any help with parking spaces or anything else. She has to deal with that, crutches and Zimmer frames and walking frames, whatever it may be, without any provision. And so there was no offer of someone to help her. You know, I would have to drive her to the local surgery to have the wounds dressed and changed. Some of this could have been done in the community. She wouldn't need to occupy hospital time to have that. So again, it's not just elderly people here. It's people of all ages who are going through having a need for domiciliary care, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And that's it. And that's one of the reasons, actually, I've recently partnered with the Royal Osteoporosis Society. And so I'm one of their business ambassadors. And it's really interesting because, actually, again, we don't really talk about it as a sector. That's kind of so early doors that we're not talking about it. And I think, gosh, you know, if I think about the demographic of my staffing team, they will all be dealing with this, if not now, then shortly. A very big percentage of my team will be dealing with that, care workers and management and so on. If I think about that end client, they will be dealing with osteoporosis. And it's really then saying, well, okay, so what can we do? Are we teaching our care workers enough? Are we partnering up enough? Are we talking about it enough? And so we're trying to raise money for them and really work with them directly. So I think it's really interesting the way we look at that.
Well, we've just started talking more openly about menopause and the impact of HRT, and which obviously has a huge impact on osteoporosis as well, certainly in women. But I guess it must also occur to men of a certain age as well, where their bone density is reducing.
Absolutely, yeah.
And maybe more money is being spent on elderly women right now because it's kind of linked to menopause and HRT, whereas elderly men are probably there's no program there, is there? People don't.
No, and I think also there's a bit of re-education that's needed from an earlier age. So you know, I've got both my parents who are in their early 70s, you know, lifting weights and really building that kind of muscle mass now to help that deterioration and increase bone density and work through all the supplements and so on. And you know, it's really talking to people at a much earlier age and stage when they're fitter, healthier, and so on. Say, well, you know, what are we doing to increase bone density, increase muscle mass? You know, when we're talking about your father or father-in-law that had the fall, you know, it's really then saying, well, okay, have I really worked on in the early years on my quads, my glutes, and really kind of made that strong enough? Because I know that after a certain age, or you know, even after the age of like 40, the deterioration is going to increase, the muscle mass is going to decrease, and so I'm left in a much kind of weaker position. And so if you think about how you want to be able to live in your 80s and 90s, you know, pick up the grandkids, play golf, tie your shoelaces, whatever that might look like, it's then saying, well, how much muscle mass do I need for that? And then how much deterioration am I going to have? Well, this is how much muscle mass I then need to build from where I am today. And it's really kind of thinking about things in a much more scientific way. Mm. You know, things like getting benchmark bloods done. You know, I've started getting into that myself now, doing like, you know, selection bloods and so on. Say, well, okay, here's my benchmark number. So I'm not looking at it in my 40s, 50s, 60s. And then saying, well, I don't know what these numbers mean. Are they up, down, sideways? Well, what are they? But, you know, getting a kind of a selection of things done earlier at any stage, really, the early can, I think, is really interesting. Because as you get older, you've got things to then pitch out against and really think about that. You know, I think there's this great guy called Peter Attia who talks about health in a really interesting way. And he talks about health, you know, 1.0, where it was bloodletting in the medieval times, you know, 2.0, which is kind of what we're in.
Leeches,
right now,
yeah.
Curing, you know, so you've got an issue, I'm giving you some medication. But we're moving into that medication 3.0, which is, or you know, or wellness and health 3.0, where we're talking about prevention in a real way. You know, we talk of prevention today, but the two things are not mirrored in terms of the way that it's delivered. Health is delivered to us and care is delivered to us from, you know, medical professionals and so on as well. It's really then thinking about you know, getting all of that information together. I think that it's closer to it in the States than it is here, because there's a much more kind of privatized system around health, and I think that makes the data flow better. And also there's a appetite for that kind of information, which I think there's probably work to be done in the UK at the moment, which hopefully, you know, will be part of that change.
I mean, I'm probably biased because I had a bit of a life epiphany about 3 or 4 years ago. So I've just turned 60 this year, and I realized at the age of 57 ish that if I wanted to stay active into my 70s, I couldn't wait until I was 67. I had to do it at 57 at least. I should have done it at 47. But so I gave up drinking, lost a lot of weight, and joined the gym, go to classes now. But I'm quite data-driven. I've got my Apple Watch. I've got my nutrition calculator, food diary. So I'm much more conscious about my own health and well-being through data points. I guess the younger generation that's coming up is used to having wearables, these technology devices. So the coming generation will be much more acutely aware of the metrics. I'm also fortunate that I do get regular bloods through my GP for various things I've had going on in my life. I get regular blood tests every 6 months, so I've been quite fortunate that things like that have happened. But you're right. If you haven't got that benchmark, you don't know what your U's and E's are. You know, your baseline lymphocyte counts, all these kind of things, even your hormone levels. When it changes, you don't know if it's up or down. You just know that it's different for you, or you've got nothing to go on. So I think, yeah, going back to the point you made at the beginning, was the prevention side. This health 3.0 is all about prevention, investment in the future. And that's got to start in our teens, isn't it?
truly. I mean, we just need to think about it, I think, you know, also just changing the way that we're educating ourselves. But, you know, I've always been into, you know, lifting weights and so on. And when I was younger, it was all about the vanity and, you know, just sort of, you know, being a big beefcake. But actually, as I've got older, it's really, it's less about, far less about the vanity and much more practical and thinking, well, you know, I've started in this year, really, I've been personal training quite a lot. And I just feel just so much stronger as well. Just, you know, just where you're going up and down stairs and you're standing up without using anything. And you just think, gosh, yeah, you know, this is it. This is what I want my strength for as I get old. Basic yeah. stuff. You know, I just want to be able to hold my kids for longer and walk with them further. And, you know, all of that practical strength. And I think as I get older, what does that look like for me? You know, how do I want to live? And what am I doing today to think about that? And so, yeah. you know, things like weight reduction and so on. I mean, I've been on a bit of a journey myself, you know, a bit more to go. But I think, again, all of these things, it takes off the burden on your ankles and your knees and so on. And it's just, you know, as long as you can safely, healthy do that, I think there's a lot there that, that as we get older, it will really help create a much more thriving stage of our life.
Yeah, but I think at the moment, it has to be my epiphany. It's not a cultural thing yeah. that it's evolving. Maybe we'll be talking about it more. But it took a personal epiphany. So you know, I bought an e-bike because I realised that I had a manual pedal bike, and I was locked in between two hills. So I could go along the bottom, but as soon as it got yeah. bumpy, I couldn't get up the side. So I bought an e-bike, and suddenly my world expanded. I can now do 25-30 miles on a Sunday morning. Whereas before, yeah. I was doing a couple hundred yards because I was blocked in. The gym, personal trainer, classes, do that. And I mentioned at the beginning, we've just got a puppy. And I look at the rings on my watch, and having the puppy, I'm doing my stand count before lunchtime now because I'm getting up yes. and doing this. I'm more active. I don't lie in bed anymore. I've got to get up, take for a walk and feed her and stuff. That's all of a sudden, just having a puppy has created this whole new fitness requirement just to be active. So, and I've been very mindful around standing from a chair without support. So, I always, when I get off the sofa now, when I get off a chair now, I'm always trying to, can I do this without support, just use momentum? And I judge that as a real progress step that I can still do that. And so, yeah, I think you're right. We have to take personal responsibility and maybe. Part of your business model, and I don't know if this is what you're thinking, is to try and bring people on that journey with you. So you're coming into that.
Yeah, really, it is. I mean, so we have around the country, we do something called Thrive Clubs, which are, you know, free clubs, and donations go to the Royal Osteoporosis Society in Redbury, and you know, where people can drop in and I'll do something active, whether it's, you know, yoga or Pilates or chair exercises. I mean, heck, in some places we even do art and so on. So just kind of creative as well, because it's not all just physical. Mm. But I think really thinking about that and saying, well, how, what are we doing and taking to the community? And actually, are we starting that journey with people much earlier? And really bring them on that journey much earlier, and then going on a much longer trajectory with them.
Is society changing? I mean, I look back at my generation, and we were probably the cause of the McDonald's problem. You know, as parents, McDonald's just launching the Happy Meal, so we were probably of that generation that started causing that obesity crisis in our kids. Have we got to the end of that phase, and we're now looking at a better. Or are we still propagating this? Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, from things I've read, you know, articles and studies that have been done with economists and so on, and also from my own personal experiences with the sort of Gen Z's or Zs or whatever they're called, the next lot that are coming up, I note that they are far more health conscious. They drink less. They don't binge drink in the way that was normal, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. They exercise more, far more kind of sort of aware of their health. And you know, you think things like these AG1s and all these kind of supplements and so on, you know, there's a much bigger kind of appetite for things like that. So I think that there is a lot of that happening. I think that we are finding that things are morphing and changing. It will take time. You know, it'll take a generation, I think, you know, but it requires all of us to carry on doing the work.
Yeah, I'm one of the millions who are using Mounjaro as a partner in my weight loss journey, and I see it as a partnership because it doesn't do all this on its own. You got to want to do it, and you got to meet it halfway, because if you don't put the effort in with it, it has no effect. But that's really woken a lot of the population up. Now it's become almost accessible to many. You know, obviously, there's still a premium price, but that is really getting people thinking about, actually, I can now do this. It's like having a little coach on your shoulder going, you can do this, you can do this. Yeah. You're paying 250 quid a month for me, you better make it worth it. I think that's in my mind. I think I don't want to keep eating the pizza and paying 250 quid for a weight loss injection. So there's a whole new generation now thinking, I want to take personal responsibility for my weight, and they're now buying into it. But there's still stigma around having help, isn't there? It's like,
yeah, I mean, but again, I think that is changing so quickly. You know, I think certainly in the people that I know, I think I know of a lot of people that are using you know, medication or whatever it might be. And also, I think that there was this wonderful article in The Economist earlier this year. It was like a 6-page spread, and it was talking about weight loss drugs, and I thought it was really interesting, because the way that they had positioned it was to say that over the next 20 years it will really change, and it will be seen as more like diabetes or a curable issue, as opposed to the way that it's seen socially today. And I think that's
laziness and lack of discipline and all those things.
Which is invariably not true, actually. You know, and it's just the way that we position it socially. And I think that, you know, that it's just not true, actually. And I really kind of look at that, and I think that's really interesting to think how sort of drug like that will change society. And I think, well, that's one of many changes that will happen, you know, and I just think that if we all just take our little bit and we, you know, focus on our sphere of influence, we can really make monumental change in how we think about aging and how we think about wellness and how we think about being older. I mean, in many ways you think, gosh, if you focus on that health trajectory, you know, you are at a stage in your life where you've worked, you've, you know, accumulated whatever you're going to accumulate. You've got a house or whatever it might be, and you know, if you are fortunate enough to do so, and actually you're able to live a much more kind of full life than you might in your 20s and 30s, because you're in that building stage and you've got young kids and so on and so forth. And so it's a really wonderful stage of life, but I think it's about repositioning the way we look at it. And so I'm really interested in how we think about aging in the UK.
I read somewhere, I can't remember the exact age, but I think it's something like, the first person to live to 150 years old has already been born or just been born. And you think, so the new generation, there will be an expectation by definition that you will live into your 120s at some point. Yeah. But what we don't want to do is live to 120 and not be fit into our 110s. Because what we can't have is two-thirds of the population being over 50, over 60. Living in care or needing domiciliary care, with the other third trying to pay for that. So we need to change our fitness and our capability so that it adjusts with our lifespan at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think we need to really change the conversation from lifespan to health span. You know, and think, well, okay, how long am I healthy for? How long am I mobile and fit for, and so on? And actually, you know, that health span. Is, you know, because we talk a lot about lifespan, don't we, and as a community, and I think really it's kind of morphing the conversation and saying, well, you know, how long am I independent and happy in who I am for, you know, and it's and really asking those sort of hard questions early doors, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we've gone past the era of golden handshake pensions where people can retire at 50 and, you know, the next generation, and Gen Xers like me and boomers like people around me, we're going to have to keep working until our mid-70s. You know, we don't have the wherewithal now. Yeah. The pension age is going to go up. Even, you know, could I afford to retire at 67? Probably not. So I need to be fit and active enough to earn some kind of living to supplement any pension I have into my 70s. And that number is going to go up by 5 years, every 10 years or whatever it may be. So we're going to need people working to their 80s. Workplaces are going to be accommodating now of multiple generations in the workplace, multiple fitness levels and multiple capability levels. And it's, we as a society can't keep ignoring that.
I think
the NHS can't cope with it.
Well, this is it. And I think we really need to think about it and think, well, what is, you know, I was talking to my nephew who's in his early 20s, said, well, you've got 50 years of work, you know, so really, you know, think about all the different incarnations you're going to have. Whatever it is that you're doing today is probably not going to be what you're doing in 20 years time and then another 20 from there, you know. And that's it. So also then at his stage, it's thinking about the wealth span that will feed into the health span and that will feed into the lifespan. And, you know, it's really thinking about that whole journey, I think, and very much like a journey, you know. And I think really kind of mapping it, planning it and thinking about it, which is not something that is comfortable to do, but I think we ought to.
But there's been an expectation that people are relying on the state to do that for them, haven't they? That's been the kind of, I suppose it came out of World War I, World War II, that sort of mentality where the state started looking after you, the NHS was formed, pension, retirement, all these concepts started evolving.
Yeah.
If you go back in time, back in history, people didn't retire. They just passed away at work
or they
became very infirm very quickly and they weren't expected to live much more than a couple of years after retirement.
Yeah. And that's it. It's very true.
Especially as the people who were in that zone were probably working class, lower middle class, probably doing manual labor, probably working in environments that were toxic and they were developing conditions. It's only, you know, health was probably for the benefit of the wealthy and the privileged few, wasn't it?
Yes, very much so, yeah.
And yeah, we now have an expectation as a society that health and well-being and wealth span, as you said, and health span should be the right of every person, regardless of financial status.
Absolutely. I think, and you know, hopefully we will work to omit that two-tier system that has formed in the UK.
Amrit, it's been a fascinating conversation. I mean, we've gone off of franchising and domiciliary care and into sort of blue skying around health and well-being into our hundreds. I've really enjoyed it. How can people get hold of you and find out more? You know, maybe you're a budding franchisee. Listen to this.
Joe, I've really enjoyed myself too as well. Thank you very much. So we're very easy to get hold of. So I'm Amrit Dhaliwal. I've got my book, which is called The Time to Thrive, Home Care Revolution, which you can find on Amazon. I have a podcast, which is called Walking with Wolfinch. It's all on all the podcast platforms. On my Instagram, which is Amrit Wolfinch, and LinkedIn, which is Amrit Dhaliwal, and then the website, which is www.wolfinchfranchising.com.
Fantastic. This is all in the UK at the moment. You're not going into Europe yet?
Currently in the UK, and, you know, let's see what happens in the future.
So throughout the UK?
We're currently throughout the UK, yes. Yeah. So the furthest north is Edinburgh, and the furthest south, I think, is Southampton.
Oh, wow. I'm in Portsmouth. So, yeah, just around the corner. Yeah.
Not far. Yes. Yeah.
Not far. So if you're in the West Country or you're in the tail end of Kent, maybe there's an opportunity there to franchise.
Yeah. I mean, we have, you know, we've got a wonderful journey to go on. I think we'll probably have about 40 locations by the end of this year, but we've probably divided the country into 200. So there's a lovely kind of 10-year journey to go on. And we're always looking for the right people to go on that journey with us. We say no a lot, but again, for the same reasons. We're looking at, you know, retention, we're looking at the right people, and we're trying to build a values-led business.
Well, I'm never going to disagree with that statement. Absolutely fantastic. Amrit, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you,
our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.